Okay, so today is the second session that we're doing on physician-assisted suicide, and today we're going to open class by looking at the second of the two Supreme Court cases that addressed physician-assisted suicide and the potential federal or constitutional right to PAS that were heard in 1997. And we talked about last time why 1997 would there have been two court cases that would wind their way through. This was the federal court system, the circuit court system, to get to the Supreme Court. And we said, because in 1996, the Oregon Death with Dignity Act was passed, and there was other ballot initiatives, one notably in Washington, and that one had failed. So the Supreme Court was ripe for looking at those two cases in 1997. Let me remind us that the other case was Vacco versus Quayle. We talked about that last week, and I'm looking at these two court cases separately only because they play on, or they attach to different arguments using the 14th Amendment, where you remember that Vacco versus Quayle uses the Equal Protection Clause aspect of the 14th Amendment. I'll show it again. But that was the argument that if you have two like cases, someone who is end stage, terminally ill, needing life-sustaining therapy, and you have another person who is end stage, terminally ill, but not needing life-sustaining therapy, those are like cases because they're end stage and terminally ill, and yet in the United States, you are able to hasten your death when you need life-sustaining therapy because you can either forego it or have it withdrawn, but you are not treated with equal protection when you don't need life-sustaining therapy and cannot forego it. And so these two cases are not treated equally, and so you do not have equal protection in terminal illness for, and you do not have the same rights. That's what the Vacco argument was playing on, the Vacco versus Quayle, the New York State case, and we saw that Rachel's fit in very nicely there as a piece that informs that court case, because Rachel's argued the same justice argument in his 1975 paper, Passive and Active Euthanasia. The Glucksberg case looks at the Due Process Clause, the clause that we think most about, those of us who are not lawyers and JD students, think most about when we think about the 14th Amendment. And let me give it to you again. The Due Process Clause is that part that we think about, the Liberty Clause, people often refer to it as, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. So those of us who are, again, not lawyers, not law students, don't really think about that as a due process clause. We think about it as surrounding the concern about liberty, but it's formally understood as this part of the amendment, and yet we focus in on this idea of liberty, and that's going to be the focal point for the court case of Washington versus Glucksberg, especially surrounding the concept of liberty and what are the liberties that citizens in the United States have access to. Is hastening one's death with the assistance of physicians part of that set, that collection of rights that includes so many rights we now understand as being substantive in there, like the right to a first trimester abortion, the right to private sexual practice in our own homes, the right to birth control, etc. Now, it is a little bit chilly, and we, again, have no one sitting in the seat of adjustment, which I totally understand, because who would want it? But we cease to have the air conditioning now that it is 65 out. Okay. So I'm going to look at the Washington versus Glucksberg case for a few minutes. I'm going to gesture towards the piece that we're going to look at for most of today's class, which is called, a little bit arrogantly, perhaps, hubristically, the philosopher's brief, because it was germane. Not only was it coincidentally germane to the Washington versus Glucksberg case, it was literally germane, because the philosopher's brief, and you already know this, I know if you're a law student or a JD, the philosopher's brief was an amicus brief, a friend of the court brief, very literally written to inform
and be part of the surrounding literature and argument for these cases. It was written to influence the Supreme Court in this case. So it wasn't just like the Rachel's paper, which clearly hovered in the background of knowledge when the opinion came down. This was absolutely directly designed to influence the court. The reason we still read it, because you might say, well, look, there's how many briefs are there that are written for any Supreme Court case, and yet we don't seem to read all those as canonized literature in bioethics. The reason we read this one, and it is canonized, it's in many, many different collections of bioethics pieces, the reason we read this one is because the arguments in favor of physician-assisted suicide are very sophisticated and very comprehensive when it comes to the legality arguments surrounding legalizing PAS. That doesn't mean they're right. It means that if you're pro-PAS and you're a legal theorist, these are the arguments that you would likely bring to bear. And so it's a great piece classically to talk about the federal right to physician-assisted suicide, whether in fact they're right or not. Now, we know already that the philosophers are on the losing side, because while the brief is written prior to the decision, we are many years post the decision, and so we know they lost. Nevertheless, their arguments are very powerful. And whether they were on the losing side because they had losing arguments is, of course, up for debate. Because sometimes you're on the losing side for reasons that aren't because you have losing arguments. But you may be on the losing side because politically the time isn't right, or because the consequences might not be good, or the climate isn't appropriate.
So you're going to have to see who has the better arguments as we walk through it. Okay, so in Glucksberg, the Ninth Circuit rules that there is a liberty interest. There is a liberty interest in choosing the time and manner of death in the 14th Amendment. And that will be exactly the arguments that the philosophers in the philosopher's brief make. These are the arguments in a nutshell, and we're going to spend most of the day looking at them, but I'm going to give you just, this is basically just the outline I've got here. We'll pick it apart piece by piece, but I want to just make the case on the pro-PAS side, and then I'll tell you what the court said when it looked at this, when it looked at the argument. They're going to argue first that there is a liberty interest inside the 14th Amendment, that in that cluster of liberties I just mentioned, the right to hasten one's death should be understood as being part of those substantive rights, especially if you have the right to determine matters of the beginning of life in your own lives, that is, through birth control, family planning, your sexual activity, or abortion, then the philosophers are going to argue we ought to understand that you have that same right at the end of life. And this is that part of the liberty clause that I just showed you. But second, they're going to argue that the liberty interest that they see in the 14th Amendment, of course, that's what all of this duking out is. It's about interpretation of a document that doesn't speak transparently to us, but we have to understand what was meant and interpret it through the culture and times we're living in. But they are going to argue that in addition to what's written in the 14th Amendment, that you can also understand this liberty interest to access physician-assisted suicide as being part of the rulings that the Supreme Court had already made, what is called precedent. And again, for those of us who are not legally trained, it might be worth noting that precedent, Supreme Court precedent specifically in the United States, is of the highest regard. So the Supreme Court doesn't just change its mind, you know, well, is it Thursday? You know, that the precedent, that the rulings that have gone before are very much revered. In fact, one of the arguments that more optimistic people who are on the pro-choice side make about Roe versus Wade, is that Roe might get chipped away at, but it won't get overturned, and that's because Supreme Court precedent stands as practically in stone. Not that it never happens, it sometimes does. The Bowers decision was overruled by the Lawrence decision, where the Bowers argument said that people did not have a right to the practice of sodomy in their own homes among consenting adults, and Lawrence v. Texas said they absolutely did, about not even 20 years later. But it is not very often that you see a Supreme Court reverse itself. So when the philosophers are looking out at past rulings, they're saying we can learn a lot about physician-assisted suicide from the rulings that were not about physician-assisted suicide, but speak to the core moral and legal principles at issue. And the two cases we're going to look at are Casey and Cruzan. And we've already talked about Cruzan last week, 2 weeks ago probably. I will talk to you about Cruzan. It's a very interesting interpretation that they have of Cruzan, not perhaps the most straightforward understanding of the meaning of Cruzan. And we'll look at Casey, which is a abortion case from Pennsylvania. And finally, they're going to argue that when the state tries to say, I have an interest in preventing physician-assisted suicide, when the government tries to say we ought not to have physician-assisted suicide for the following reasons, the state makes an argument, and the philosophers are going to argue those arguments are weak. So the third part of the philosopher's brief is going to be a rebuttal to what they see as the state's core concerns about PAS. This will be a rebuttal part of the argument. So, what happens? Okay. The Supreme Court argues that there's no doubt that that liberty section of the 14th Amendment has broadened our understanding of what rights we have. Because after all, prior, for example, to Griswold, a married couple couldn't be assured that they had the right to access birth control, for example. So there's no doubt about it. Or prior to Roe versus Wade, you could not be guaranteed the right to have access to abortion in the first trimester. There's no doubt about it that the Liberty Clause has been understood to have an ever-increasing set of substantive rights in it. But the court says that all of those expansions have been very much rooted in the core principles and values of the United States. That is deeply rooted in our history and tradition. I'm not sure what you're going to make of that claim, because many people think about the expansion, and again, if the legal scholars in here see me going off the rails, make sure that you get into this conversation and, you know, get me back on track. But it seems to me that many legal scholars worry about activist courts, courts that read into that clause, or read into any clause, more rights than others think may be there, or maybe even more rights than the populace in general is ready to see there. And I'll give you a classic example. It was not the case that the overwhelming majority of Americans thought that abortion in the first trimester was morally permissible. To this day, and we're 35 years later, it's 50-50 even now. So to say that we are able to access abortions in the first trimester because it's deeply rooted in our tradition doesn't seem to quite track. I'm not sure that in 2004 the majority thought that sodomy was a morally approved practice. So I'm not sure that they've got a great case here when they talk about some of the actual rights that we now see in that set. But at any rate, that's their line of argument here. And they say, in contrast to all of those rights that we have now understood to be in that clause, suicide isn't among them. So thinking about physician-assisted suicide as suicide per se. Now, proponents of physician-assisted suicide don't actually think about it in the same category as suicide. Because and you may, if you're an opponent, or maybe that even if you're a proponent, you may see it as analogous. But many people on the pro-PAS side do not think that suicide and PAS are very close cousins as practices. Because in physician-assisted suicide, at least done by the stipulations of the poster child, which is Oregon, you have to be terminally ill. So you aren't in the prime of your life. Cutting off your life for reasons of no longer wanting to live, per se, you are trying to not have your death be an excruciating process or something that you can't tolerate, though death is imminent. And so for many people, the term, the concept of suicide doesn't quite fit.
And it's understandable that if you do put the label or you use the umbrella or rubric of suicide and put PAS under it, you might have a very different look and outlook about PAS than if you see PAS as quite distinct from what we think about as suicide,
especially individuals who are committing suicide and could and have a long and potentially prosperous life in front of them. But what they say, at any rate, about suicide and PAS by extension is, we are confronted with a consistent and almost universal tradition that has long rejected this asserted right. In other words, suicide has been a big no in the United States forever, and we don't see anybody saying suicide's a great thing. It's not part of our tradition. And here's what they write. The decision to commit suicide with the assistance of another may be just as personal and profound as the decision to refuse unwanted medical treatment. Remember, that's the like versus like case. But it's never enjoyed similar legal protection. Again, a little bit odd. It's 1997, and your right to have food and hydration removed isn't a right that you have guaranteed until 1990, so I'm not sure what it means by never enjoyed similar legal protection. It's not like you've had legal protection for 100 years to have your food and hydration removed. And even the ability to have your ventilator removed isn't exactly going back to the founding fathers. It was the 1975 Quinlan case that kicked that all off, and that was only a New Jersey case. So, not, you know, they speak in a time frame that may not feel quite authentic. But they argue, throughout the nation, Americans are engaged in an earnest and profound debate about the morality, legality, and practicality of PAS. And our holding, the ruling of these two cases, permits this debate to continue, as it should in a democratic society.
What's happening here? And it's what I'm going to follow up with in the Gonzalez case, which happens about 10 years later. This is a court that very much believes in states' rights. And so this is not a court that is saying, you have no right, you cannot have physician-assisted suicide. They're merely arguing, you don't have a federally protected right to physician-assisted suicide because it is a state matter. It is up to states. And while Americans in different states are having a profound and very reflective decision about whether they want access to this in their own states, it is not our place to be an activist court and shortchange that discussion and give a federal right to everyone.
It belongs with the states. That's what the ruling is. So it does not say that you may not have a state give you the right to PAS. It says the court will not give you a federal right that belongs to the states. And that rationale in Glucksberg and Vacco are going to be very important when we get to Gonzalez, and you're going to see this in a minute. So there's no federal constitutional right to PAS. There's no constitutional prohibition against PAS. That's where we get to in the courts in 97. And again, that rationale explains the decision in the Gonzalez case. This is Gonzalez versus Oregon. Gonzalez was the Attorney General under Bush, George Bush the second, obviously, because it's in the 2006. This is the Attorney General of the United States trying to make a prohibition, trying to end the Oregon Death with Dignity Act in the state of Oregon. This is the federal government trying to tell the state of Oregon, you may not have physician-assisted suicide. Now, we already know, because we just read our Vacco and our Glucksberg, that the court was pretty darn clear that this was a state matter. But you have a more conservative court in 2006, and so from the Bush administration's perspective, worth the old college try to see if you can get Oregon's Death with Dignity Act repealed on grounds not that that it violates the Constitution's liberty interest, because that was going to be a hard sell, because they just said it doesn't, but it doesn't have it in there either, but instead that it violates federal protected substances regulations.
because in order for you to access physician-assisted suicide in Oregon, you must use a federally controlled substance, barbiturates. And so what the Gonzales camp, the Bush administration, tried to argue is, sure, in principle, Oregon has the right to decide as a state whether they're going to have physician-assisted suicide, but they're not going to be allowed to have the drugs that make it possible, because they are federally controlled, and this use in the state of Oregon violates the federal statutes on how you're allowed to use these federally controlled substances. End run around Oregon with a very sympathetic court. So you know how this is going to go. Except, whoops, the Bush administration misfired and did not correctly predict how this was going to go, and I'll tell you why. U.S. Attorney General claims that using a controlled substance in Oregon for PAS was a federal crime. The U.S. Supreme Court disagreed. They said, the state law lets you have PAS. You got to have the means to bring that about. In fact, what happens, the reason there is this misfire with Gonzales, with the Gonzales versus Oregon, is because the Bush administration was looking at a court that was socially conservative for sure, but also very much pro-states' rights, as is often the case. Not always, but you often will see a conservative court be very pro-states' rights. And in this case, the states' rights part of the court simply overruled any of the social conservative tendencies or trends in that court. And it wasn't even close. It was a humiliating 6-3. So what the Gonzales court said, what the Gonzales decision said was, absolutely Oregon's allowed to have PAS. We already said that, because it's a state's matter. And if we're going to let it up to the states to have it, we're not going to end run our previous decision and make it so that you can't do it on some technicality of drugs. We're not doing that. That's a state's matter. And it's such a state's matter that states continue to debate these issues. And in the 2008 election, both Washington and Montana voted up physician-assisted suicide. So three states now. With Vermont at least thinking about it, but I don't know where that stands. Okay, so that's what happened. And now, whether you agree with the court or not, that it is merely a state's decision, we're going to look at the arguments that the philosophers make in the philosopher's brief about why the court should recognize a federal right to physician-assisted suicide, both in the actual Constitution, in their prior rulings, and in the failure of their arguments to make a good case against it. Again, knowing that maybe the reason that they voted down the federal right, or didn't recognize the federal right, wasn't so much about who had the best arguments, but about whether states' rights versus federal rights versus the activist court versus a populace not ready could have been any number of reasons. So let's take a look and see what we think. All right. The first move that... So I should tell you a little bit about these philosophers, too, because, boy, I mean, how many philosophers are there in the country? Thousands? And there's how many on this paper? 6 philosophers. So the idea that they call this the philosopher's brief does seem a little bit overblown. Why do they call this the philosopher's brief? And I'll tell you why. Because in 1997, this was a who's who like you can't believe. The people on it were top legal and moral philosophers from mostly the East Coast, because that's, you know, the happening kind of place. But basically, you have Judith Jarvis Thompson, who wrote the piece that we'll look at in a couple of weeks on abortion at MIT. Tim Scanlon, who was at Harvard. John Rawls was at Harvard. Robert Nozick was at Harvard. Only Tim Scanlon is still alive. John Rawls and Nozick have died. And then Dworkin and Nagel were both at NYU, which is considered the number one legal philosophy department in the country. So not necessarily the top law school, but in terms of legal philosophy, hands down number one. And it's Dworkin et al., so it's Dworkin who's the lead author on this. Okay, one of the things that's interesting about the philosopher's brief is that these philosophers agree on nothing else except that there is a federal right to physician-assisted suicide.
Nozick, for example, was a very hardcore libertarian. Except for roads and maybe, you know, the army, everything else should be private, and there should be no federal or state taxes to do any of the social services we have. That was Nozick. You got John Rawls, who's we'll read in the spring, if you haven't been with me for Conceptual Foundations, we'll read his book, A Theory of Justice, where he basically says that the U.S. should become Sweden and have that level of welfare state. You know, their offices right next door to each other at Harvard. These people agree on nothing except this. And that was the other miracle of this piece of argumentation. Now, you get six philosophers arguing on one side, and you can believe you're going to have a pretty formidable argument. So part of why we look at this is that argumentation-wise, this thing is at a pretty high level, which does not mean you can't refute it. The Supreme Court thumbed their nose at it. But basically, we're definitely going to have a real piece of intellectual work here. Okay. Let's talk about their first move, because it's a very interesting accusation that they make about the court. And we want to ask whether that same accusation that they make of the court is an accusation we might be able to turn within and make of them. But the general strategy is this. I'm going to be in the voice of Dworkin. My arguments are so absolutely airtight. They are so good that if you do not buy them, there can only be one explanation. Your biases, your own worldview, is blinding you to the absolute intellectual clarity and precision of these arguments. That's the opening move. Okay? You're not, obviously, taking my argument seriously because you're being blown about by your own worldview. And they say this at the beginning on 258. In the left-hand column, I'm going to read it almost at the bottom. Though it's really interesting. As I read this, knowing that their accusation is going to be, you're biased, pay attention to the way in which they make this accusation to see if you sniff out any bias or worldview or particular perspective. Denying that opportunity to terminally ill patients who are in agonizing pain or otherwise doomed to an existence they regard as intolerable could only be justified on the basis of a religious or ethical conviction about the value or meaning of life itself. And our Constitution forbids government to impose such convictions on its citizens. How might you argue that the philosophers weren't exhibiting the most neutral approach to that accusation in that phrasing? Or do you think they were? It just seems that they're... No, of course, there's what other words would they use? What could make them vulnerable to, well, aren't you biased too, in the way that that accusation was just phrased?
Their verbiage is strong. I mean, if you have any scale, I mean, it's...
Okay. So, for example, they call PAS... an opportunity. Of course, it isn't, in a sense, an opportunity, but to think about having a physician assist you in your death as an opportunity is to say what about physician-assisted suicide? What does the word opportunity do for them in that sentence? What does it do?
Something good.
Yes. It already casts it as, you know, you wouldn't want to miss this opportunity. You know, it already has a positive. So it doesn't have the gravitas of an action or, you know, an event. It's an opportunity. So you want to get on it now while it's hot. Okay. What about the idea of agonizing pain, doomed to an existence that's intolerable? What does that say about, how does that speak to a lack of neutrality? How could that be rephrased if they weren't pro?
They could say who may be in agonizing pain because it's not necessarily painful.
Okay. You could
they're making assumptions and assuming that all persons who would seek this would do it because of a pain.
Okay. All right. So one thing is that they put pain up front because one of the things that people are often most sympathetic to are people dying in pain. So there's no doubt that already prioritizing pain as one of the reasons, and we'll talk about multiple reasons why someone might want to access PAS in terminal illness and end stage. But it is also the case that you don't actually need the word agonizing. In fact, philosophers are usually fairly chintzy with their adjectives. They don't write in flowery language typically, so the fact that they've put the word agonizing in is already a little bit of a tip-off that they're trying to make sure that you get the most graphic picture of suffering that you possibly can. Philosophers usually speak in sanitized language, so they would usually say pain and suffering, which doesn't pull at the heartstrings like agonizing. They also wouldn't use the word doomed. They wouldn't talk about an intolerable existence. They would say individuals who no longer find life worth living, something that's de-escalated from that position. Okay, so what I want to look at for a minute is what they're accusing the court of, and I want to give it some philosophical language because it's a concept that we're going to use quite often in this semester, and if you stay with me for the spring, we'll use it there as well. What they are accusing the court of doing is bringing their own conception of the good into their decision. The conception of the good is a phrase that was actually coined by John Rawls, one of the authors of this piece, 20 years earlier, more than 20 years, 25 years earlier, in The Theory of Justice. And he used it as this umbrella term to describe what is of the highest importance in a particular human being's life, knowing that human beings, as diverse as we all are, will have very different conceptions of what is good. Good morally, good in terms of what your values are in life, good in terms of what you're striving for, good in terms of your priorities, what you think is the good life. What you think is the good life is very unique to you. Not perhaps, you know, there's no overlap. I mean, there are other people who share your values, of course, and those people might be found in your communities, people with your same hobbies, people in your same professions, people with your same political persuasions or causes. I'm not saying there's no overlap. But whatever is that constellation of values, priorities, religious views, your life goals and aspirations, that is the set that philosophers refer to as the conception of the good. And while they don't name that as a concept here, that is what they're playing off of, and what they're arguing is that the court, when it makes its decision, is not looking at the pure rationality of the arguments for or against PAS, but the court is sneaking in the individual justice's own worldview and value commitments that lead them in the direction of anti-PAS should they decide against Quill and against Washington, which we know they did. So we know in hindsight that the argument that the philosophers are going to make against the court is, obviously you didn't look at the really great arguments. What was it that made you decide what you did? It was your conception of the good. Thinking about our own conception of the good is very important, not just for this, for PAS, for all kinds of applications in bioethics, even in clinical ethics. We teach mediation as an alternative to clinical ethics dispute resolution, what is often understood as clinical ethics. Penn has a very particular understanding of how we should resolve clinical ethics disputes, and one of the things we argue in mediation is that you have to be very careful when you are the mediator to try to understand and keep at bay your own conception of the good rather than sneaking in your own biases, like a situation that's futile, you should always withdraw care, or miracles never happen, or miracles do happen, or whatever it is, that we are arguing you have to be very careful not to sneak in your conception of the good in clinical ethics resolutions as the clinical ethicist or mediator. But that's a very formalized requirement of justices. Justices, the government in the United States, which is a very, I'm going to use the word liberalist constitution, a constitution that comes from Locke and Rousseau. The way that the constitution was set up at the beginning was that the government is not supposed to sneak in the values of the government officials and impose that on the populace. the government is supposed to clear the way for you to live life on your own terms. And that goes all the way back to the beginning, when people who came from other places came for religious freedom here and didn't want a nation that was going to impose one religion. I'm not saying we live up to this. I'm saying this was the ideals, that we were not supposed to have a country that imposed a religious view or a religious denomination or set of values on the populace, but instead was supposed to give us freedom from intervention, freedom of religion, freedom of speech, so that you could live life on your own terms. Now, so when they say that our Constitution forbids government to impose such convictions on its citizens, they are saying, you justices, whatever your views are, don't impose them on me. Read the Constitution, read the precedent, look at the arguments, but don't sneak in your own personal values into this, because you are not allowed to do it, not by our Constitution. But then that leads us to ask this question, and we'll ask it in both directions. If you are anti-PAS, what could elements be of your conception of the good that would drive you unconsciously to say no to Washington and no to Quill and argue against a federal right to physician-assisted suicide? What are those elements? And then we're going to turn the table and we're going to ask, all right, that cuts both ways. If you're pro-PAS, what would your elements be that, regardless of how good or how weak these arguments are, would lead you to pro-PAS no matter what? So our first exercise today is to figure out what could the elements be of the justices on that court, or of anyone in the room, anyone in the country, that would lead you unconsciously, unreflectively, committedly to an anti-PAS position. What do you got for me? So this is a thinking exercise, not in the book.
No one should be in a position to take another one.
Okay, good. Right? It is no one's right to take a life or facilitate the taking of that life or for the killing of that life. Yep, absolutely, that could be one. Now, these aren't all going to hang together as one set. This is just some hodgepodge. So we can just tease out how deep is the accusation. Not just, again, about this. We'll use this as a frame for many things in bioethics. Well, because remember, one of our tasks this semester is to try to understand the power of argument versus the other stuff that influences people when they're engaging in bioethical debate that's not actually argument. Not that we're not all vulnerable to it, which is why we're going to run the exercise in both directions. Okay, that's one. What else? Go ahead.
Just a general feeling of, like, the sanctity of life.
Okay. Sanctity of life. And that could be either from a religious perspective, or it could actually be from a secular perspective. We are very familiar with it from the religious perspective. Many churches will talk about the sanctity of life, and they do that from a theist perspective. That is, from the perspective that there is God, and God deems human life to be of such infinite value that it is not touchable. But Immanuel Kant, who is no theist, who is writing from a very secular perspective, also has the same view, that human life is of infinite value. It cannot be traded. He was adamantly opposed to suicide. He didn't know PAS. He wrote in 1804 and in the late 1700s, but he absolutely would have had the view that there is a sanctity of life, human dignity understood as infinite worth of all human beings. So you could do it religious or secular. What else? What is it?
Yeah.
All right. The slippery slope. So that first, all we're doing is people are terminally ill and they're competent. Because remember, our whole discussion of PAS starts with the competent, people like you and me. But pretty soon we're killing compromised newborns and the mentally disabled and then people in wheelchairs. And oh my God, we're going to, who knows where we're going to go. All right, that could be a view, a fear, or even a legitimate concern. Who knows? What else?
The decision might be based on conditions that can be changed, for example.
Okay, so, all right, so that it's kind of a situational decision, not really a legitimate one, not really a one of full consent, for example, or full informed consent or full autonomy. Think about Bouvet. Interestingly, Bouvet wins her court case to have her food and hydration removed, only to then be given better care and
decides not to starve herself? Could you have a worse poster child for wanting to be able to end your life with medical assistance than somebody who's still alive 20 years later after winning the right to kill herself? You know, how many people, and there are biases, like there are views, I don't mean a bias, we all have biases, so when I use that word I don't mean it's pejorative, but there are people whose views are, if we were doing outstanding palliative care, there wouldn't be any requests for PAS. That could be a correlate, that do palliative care right, and you've already resolved the PAS problem. I'm going to be over here on the pro-PS side saying I don't believe that that's true, but there are plenty of people who will believe, again, from a secular perspective, when palliative care is done right. And you know who one of those people is? Quill. Quill. Quill, as in Bacow versus Quill, is not a crusader anymore for PAS. He's a crusader for palliative sedation. You know, we can palliate you to a point where you are unconscious, if that's what you want, but you're still a living, breathing being and we're not terminating your life. So there are lots of people who are on that side and also very concerned about this issue. Okay, what else?
Coercion or unduly influenced.
All right. So we could be worried that there's just no way to get outside of coercion. Okay? Is that going to be yours?
Yeah.
All right. What else? One of the arguments that Leon Cass worries about is that the people on the pro-PAS side, and maybe I'll ask you this before I give it away, and then I'll go back to Leon Cass, what are the main arguments, the main feelings or value commitments on the pro-PAS side? Let's list a couple, and we'll definitely hit the one that'll get us back over here. Let's turn the tables for a minute. What are the core biases, the core commitments of the pro-PAS faction?
To let people die with dignity.
All right, die with dignity. That's actually going to be the one that gets us back over to Cass. We'll come back for a minute and let's talk about this. People like Leon Cass, who are adamantly opposed to physician-assisted suicide, have a very particular view of dignity and the claim that you ought to be able to die with dignity, which a lot of people on the pro-PS side say. Let's talk about what we mean by dignity. What do most people mean when they say the phrase, I want to be able to die with dignity? I mean, hell, it was a song in the musical Rent, Will I Die with Dignity? It was part of the musical. So you know what it means, otherwise you would have gotten to that line in the play and been like, what would that mean? But you know exactly, right? These were men and women dying of AIDS in the early AIDS crisis in the late 80s, and you know exactly what they meant. What did they mean?
Control the time and manner of your death.
Maybe, but in the late 80s, there was no physician-assisted suicide. So those men and women dying of AIDS couldn't have meant, will I be able to die when I want to? When they said they were going to die, they wanted to die with dignity, would they lose their dignity? What were they worried they were going to lose?
Maybe some sort of dehumanizing suffering.
Like what?
Like being in so much pain that you can't take care of basic bodily needs and have a conversation.
Okay. For some people, dignity will be a kind of level of cognition. Absolutely. And for many, it will actually be about bodily control. It will, or it could even be about the aesthetic of the body. So those are three things we can think about. Let's talk about the control of the body. What does that mean? It means that adults do not want to wear diapers. Adults don't want to be able to toilet by themselves. They want to be able to shower. They don't want to be able to be wetting their beds. That's a kind of that's a state that adults feel is an often will say that's an undignified situation. If you can't make cognitive sense, you no longer have your cognitive faculties in order, so you're not making sense. Some people will say that's a life without dignity. And some people will say, if my body doesn't have a certain minimal aesthetic standard, I've lost all my hair, I look like I'm wasted. If you think about some of the pictures of people in late stage AIDS or late stage cancer where they look like they're wasting, or I've got bed sores, or I can't style my hair anymore, or any of the things that, I mean, after all, we have part of human beings' outward engagement in the world has a lot to do with aesthetics. Otherwise, we wouldn't spend money on various pieces of clothing in clothing stores. We just all wear, you know, some comfy sweats type of uniform or something, right? Obviously, there is an aesthetic component to human life. Any of these or some combination of those is what people mean typically when they say, I want to die with dignity. And that is of paramount importance for many people in their conception of the good of those who are pro-PAS.
So back to the anti-side on the question of dignity. What would somebody like Leon Cass, who's adamantly opposed to PAS, say about those dignity concerns? They have, Leon Cass, not everybody, again, there are many different people in this camp, and they don't all share the same values. But on that dignity score, there are some in that camp who have a very particular rebuttal to that.
That we wouldn't propose to do away with people who have these.
All right. So you shouldn't eliminate yourself or others on dignity grounds. And so all right, you can't take as good a care of yourself. Does that mean we ought to kill them off? Does that mean you're allowed to take yourself off the planet for that? Okay, so what are they really, then what's another thing that people could be saying who are like Leon Cass on dignity? How, this is a big, big concern. It has to be a big concern, or it wouldn't have made it into a musical, right? This is a very big concern among many, many people. What does someone like Leon Cass think about this concern? Yes, first of all, they think, well, that's not good ground to kill somebody. But they also think, what about the person who feels this way about themselves?
This is different, but think that natural death is sort of more dignified than suicide.
Okay, so they think that the dying process is dignified. Because it's part and parcel of being a human being. Part of what Leon Cass's view about all of these matters related to physician-assisted suicide and withholding and withdrawing care, and you know why I'm talking about Leon Cass, right? He's one of the most formidable of the conservative bioethicists. He was on Bush's, he led Bush's bioethics commission, and so he's often, and he's a very renowned professor from the University of Chicago, so he's a really sophisticated version of the opponent's side to the philosophers and the philosopher's brief. But he argues that human beings cannot lose their dignity. Dignity is what it means to actually be human, and you can't actually lose that. We talk about being dehumanized, but dehumanized is a ruse. If you're human, you have a kind of dignity. And the dying process is part of the full life course process, where you start out dependent, you become very independent, and yes, in the dying process, you become dependent again. But that's the human condition. That's what we are called to. And so to say that you want to shortchange that cycle and not take it to its own fruition is to just misunderstand, for example, some of the important life lessons or sequelae that come from going through with that process, not just for yourself, but for others. One of the things Leon Cass talks about in a piece, I don't know that I've assigned it, but it's interesting. If you want the piece, I can give you access to it. But he says that for the people who are having the opportunity to take care of you, there is a growth, especially when they're your loved ones. There is such an emotional maturation that happens, for example, from adult children having to take care of their parents, that to not have that experience is to not fully mature, is to not have the opportunity to fully mature and be the caretaker of someone that took care of you. So he thinks that there's quite a few values. There are also people who believe that suffering is redemptive. So even if you are suffering, there's a redemption that comes either in this life or the next from having gone through that ordeal. Now, these would be some of the worldviews that would be explain a very anti-PASI. Okay, we started down the pro-PAS, and we definitely talked about people should be able to die with dignity, which means forestall certain types of indignities. What are the other pro-PAS world? Views, you know, commitments.
Mm-hmm. It's a right, it's basic rights.
Okay, it's a basic right. So I have the right to die when I deem it appropriate, when I believe that my life is no longer worth living. That is my right, it's my values, it's not yours. So you want to live in a diaper, have at it. I'm not trying to kill you, I'm trying to get the right to get barbiturates for me. So there's very much a very high autonomy thread for many people in their conception of the good who are on the pro-PAS side. I'm not telling you to do it, I'm asking for the right for myself. I'm not trying to impose on you, but that's what I believe. Okay, what else?
How about like equality of condition with those that might be in a condition in which you could withdraw support?
Yep, yeah. Okay. There might be a justice argument, the like is like, that there's a fundamental unfairness at the way some people have access to being able to forge their own destiny with time and manner of death. I shouldn't be denied that. That's a violation for me. Okay, what else?
What goes wrong with the autonomy thing, but it's for each individual to decide, like, whether or not you define dying as more dignified.
All right, okay. So the meaning of dying is up to the individual. So while some may find that the dying process has all kinds of benefits for oneself or for others, for me, dying, like having a headache, just doesn't bring anything. You have a headache, I just don't see any value in it. So take the Excedrin. You want to suffer through it to understand this, that, or the other thing about yourself? Great, just don't swallow the pills. But that's not what I think is a positive about dying. In fact, what I think is a positive about dying is to, and then fill in the blank. Mm-hmm.
No one else should be able to say what I can do with my own body.
Okay, so this is the my body argument. This is one of the core elements of a pro, of an anti, a pro-choice, position would be it's my body and I have the right to my own body. So it's not just what I can do in general, but there's something very specific about being the owner and path forger of this body.
It's kind of cool, but is there an argument to be made that it's just not financially feasible to keep yourself?
Oh, yes. Yes. Yes, you could, for example, and you could phrase this in lots of ways. I'm going to put it as the least draconian, which would be, I don't want to be a burden. I get to decide how my existence fits into the finances of my family, my community, my country, you know, whatever it is. For many people, it takes the form of a family where my existence for the next 6 weeks will be very costly. My death will not be costly. Don't tell me that I can't save my family 6 weeks of getting nothing out of me but losing a whole lot of money in the process, because I've got a responsibility, moral or fiduciary or whatever it is, to protect the finances. And that not burden argument can be also an emotional. It could be a financial burden, but it could also be emotional. I don't see that my children, my loved ones, my spouse is going to get anything out of my existence, but they are going to get a lot of heartache, and I should be the one who gets to decide whether they're spared that. All right, you're getting the idea here, so we're going to move on. But the general claim the philosophers make is, you don't buy these profound arguments from the six heavy hitters of the time, then obviously you got a whole lot of bias going on here, and we understand that they have a whole lot of bias going on too, even in the creation of those arguments. So one of the things philosophers, bioethicists, have to be mindful of is, where are the biases that make you view the arguments and make the arguments that you make, which is not the same thing as saying that they can't be defended, that they can't be protected against rebuttal, but it is worth noting as you make arguments and critique them where your own biases or the biases of those making the arguments are coming into play. So keep that in mind as we go through what the philosophers think are three slam dunk, it's clear we should have a federal right arguments. Alrighty, let's start with the first. I already alluded to this one when we did the PowerPoint, but their first claim is there's a liberty clause, and we have found all kinds of things in that liberty clause. And I'm saying we have found all kinds of things because prior to a certain point, and the lawyers in here and the legal scholars can highlight and pinpoint this better than I can, but certainly in recent memory, the liberty expansion seems, at least for the layperson's eyes, to come once you start with Griswold and Roe and civil rights, and this is where we get the anti-segregation laws, and then Lawrence. It seems like we are in a cascade of finding liberty interests. But to the argument that we can't find physician-assisted suicide in there, we can't find the right to decide the time and manner of your death in terminal illness, the philosophers have the argument as a rebuttal that it's odd then
that we could decide the beginning of life. When ought life to continue?
When in pregnancy ought life to be allowed to come to fruition to the point of a pregnancy that results in a live birth? And here's why you might think that if you allow abortion, you sure as hell should allow PAS. Because whatever you want to say about the embryo or the fetus, you're not going to say that the embryo or the fetus had any choice in the matter about whether its carrier consulted the fetus or the embryo. In other words, we do have the right, women at least, to decide if life gets to continue, but the life that does or does not get to continue isn't actually asked. And yet, in end of life, when we're talking about somebody at terminal illness, it would be an autonomous decision about the body of the person who is actually going to be the one who dies. So if you stepped back and were a Martian, came from another planet, which would seem more morally complex? I have a couple of weeks or months to live, I'm competent and I'm making a decision about me, or I may be preventing, and again, I'm not taking a stance on abortion here, I'm just saying if you were a Martian and you're looking down on it, I get to decide whether an embryo that I'm carrying could potentially have 80 years and I'm not going to consult the embryo about it. I decide for the embryo. Again, not opposed to being pro-choice, but it does seem to me, at least in the voice of the philosophers, that deciding for your own body when you're almost, you know, you're dying anyway seems at least less morally loaded than the first one, and yet we have that right. So the first argument they make is, you got this right? It seems to me you got to have that right. That's their first argument. Not complicated whether you buy it or not, fairly straightforward. The second set of arguments they make are trickier. So I want to look at them in more detail, because you either buy what they just said or you don't. Okay. When they are asking the justices to think through what substantive rights ought to be in the Liberty Clause, they are saying to the justices, you've already thought through this many times and made rulings many times, and that's what we're calling precedent. That's what precedent is. There are precedents, they say, that speak to this very issue. For example, there was Casey versus Planned Parenthood. Now this, in a way, looks like the same loaded argument I just made a minute ago about how can you have an abortion right but not a PAS right, but that's not really what they use Casey for. And again, that's why it takes a little bit more explanation if you've read the piece. There are parts of this piece that are actually pretty dense and maybe even impenetrable. Let's talk about the Casey versus Planned Parenthood. The Casey decision was an abortion case. Who was Casey, by the way? Planned Parenthood, you get. This is Pennsylvania. Who was Casey?
Casey ended up being the governor.
The governor of Pennsylvania, right, exactly. So this is the government of Pennsylvania taking a suit against Planned Parenthood. Or the other way around, actually. Planned Parenthood making a case against Casey. And the reason is because Planned Parenthood objected to three elements of Pennsylvania law that were part of Pennsylvania abortion law. One, spousal notification. Two, 24-hour wait to get an abortion. You go to the abortion clinic, you get your counseling, and then you have to come back. You have to have a 24-hour wait to think it over. And parental consent. Planned Parenthood, I think rightfully, understood the Pennsylvania statute as trying to chip away at Roe, because pro-life folks had been very frustrated at their inability to just get the full prize, which is to get Roe overturned. Still frustrated, 35 years later. So there's been a lot of attempts over the years to see if abortion could be very much constrained or if the rights could be chipped away at. Partial birth abortion was one of those attempts. So when Planned Parenthood attacked the Pennsylvania law, they say that three elements of the law in Pennsylvania created an undue burden and threatened the rights of women to exercise the liberty interest that they had been granted in Roe v. Wade. the end of the story, since this is not a discussion of Casey and Planned Parenthood, was that two of the three of these were allowed to stand, at least with some qualification. The Supreme Court argued that two of the three of them did not threaten Roe and did not undermine a woman's ability to get an abortion and the right to an abortion. Which one got thrown out? Yeah, spousal notification. An adult woman did not have to tell her husband that she was having an abortion. The 24-hour wait was held. You have to come back in Pennsylvania. So you go, you're counseling, and then you come back on that date. You know, whatever the date is, that's still true. And parental consent was upheld, though they understood the argument that some women wouldn't be able to talk to their parents safely, that they could be under threat, either financial or emotional. And so in the case of a woman fearing whatever reprisals for telling parents, the court could stand in loco parentis, and you could get permission from the court. And because a woman under 18 could get permission from the court and didn't have to go to her parents to get parental consent, then they said that that did not burden a woman's right to choose. That's what the Casey decision was about. Now, that is not what the philosophers are going to get out of Casey. What the philosophers, and you see it even in the language that I highlighted when I talked about the Supreme Court decision, what they get out of Casey is the conclusion that abortion is about the realm of what is personal and intimate decisions. And the court reaffirmed that in the arena, in given our various conceptions of the good, when it comes to the personal and intimate decisions of your life, those decisions are yours. That was the rationale. So then the philosophers argue, well, could there be anything more personal and intimate than the decision about whether in terminal illness you want to have your life extended to its natural death or you want to hasten it and decide the time and manner, given that you are end stage? That to the philosophers, Casey's rationale already deemed the court amenable to a whole arena of human life, a whole part of the human experience, namely decisions that were personal and intimate. And you see the court actually responding to this claim of the philosophers when they say there is no doubt that the PAS does hit the personal and intimate. So they agree. Casey does say this, and that this is, PAS does qualify in the same way abortion does to this arena of human decision making. But then they add that clause, but suicide's never had any protection. Remember, that's that part of the PowerPoint that we looked at. All right. So the first move the philosophers make is Casey gives us the court's view that the personal and intimate decision making realm of our lives is our own, not the court's. Okay. That's what they do with Casey. Any questions on Casey? And then they moved to Cruzan. Now, Cruzan we know very well. So we did a whole long spiel on Cruzan. But they do a lot with Cruzan. Let's remind ourselves. Some of you probably weren't even in the class the day that we looked at Cruzan, and others of you, it's just like Cruzan and Bouvet is all running together. So I just wanted to do this one-minute review of the Cruzan case. Cruzan is the case of Nancy Cruzan. She was in a PBS state. She was not on a ventilator. She could breathe on her own, but she needed food and hydration. Her parents wanted her food and hydration removed, but the state of Missouri said, we don't have clear and compelling evidence that this is what Nancy would want, and they said no. It got kicked up to the Supreme Court, remember, because the Cruzan family said that the clear and compelling evidence standard was not constitutional if you were allowed to withdraw or withhold life-sustaining therapy. So what was at issue constitutionally, what made it interesting for the Supreme Court, was whether states, Florida, Missouri, New York, that have a high evidentiary standard in circuit decision-making cases, that that's what you would have wanted. They want clear and compelling evidence before life-sustaining therapy is removed. The question before the court was, is that overburdening? Is that unconstitutional? Is that too much to ask? And the Supreme Court said, no, that's not too much to ask. That's fine. Absolutely fine. So in the Cruzan case that we think of as being a big win for the Cruzan family lost the case. Missouri won the case, not Cruzan. Head scratcher. How come we think this is the big milestone in individual rights to have food and hydration removed? Because in the opinion, they said But P.S., let me make it clear. Respirator is clearly a life-sustaining therapy. So is food and hydration. So while Missouri can have a high evidentiary bar for any surrogate decision-making case that involves the removal or the withholding of life-sustaining therapy, don't split hairs with me on food and hydration and ventilator. It's all the same thing. And if you can get rid of the ventilator, you can get rid of food and hydration. So they shut down forever the Schiavo kind of case that says food and hydration is different from respirator. They say, no, it's not. That said, Missouri can have any bar they want. Okay, so that's what the Cruzan case was about. But of course, what is a case about? Well, that's always the question. So the philosophers, when they think about Cruzan, say, I know you think that this is about having treatment withdrawn. That's what you think about the Cruzan case. If the whole thing is about having treatment withdrawn or withheld. It isn't. It's about deciding time and manner of death. Let's think about this again, because that's the whole crux here. Okay. If you think Cruzan is about the withholding and withdrawing of life-sustaining therapy, it doesn't have any relevance to PAS. It's just not relevant. In PAS, you don't have any life-sustaining therapy that you could withhold or withdraw. So it's just not pertinent. The philosophers say, you think that's what Cruzan is about? It isn't. The whole fuss, the whole right, is about enabling patients to decide that they are ready to die. That what is involved in the Cruzan case is actually being able to decide the time and manner of your death, and that Cruzan, even if it's hydration, even if it's food, even if it's breath, it's all about deciding time and manner of death. That's the core of the ruling. It's what they're really saying, sanctioning, supporting, backing, that you are allowed, yes, in Missouri with a fairly high bar, and in Pennsylvania with hardly any bar or whatever, but you are allowed to decide the time and manner of your death, at least, you know, in that case, there was a withdrawal and withholding case. But if you can decide the time and manner of your death when you've got life-sustaining therapy, then the core principle is you're allowed to decide the time and manner of your death even if you don't. So they say the core meaning of Cruzan is really about time and manner of death. Oh, yes. But what you're going to say back in the voice of the core is there is a huge difference between deciding time and manner of your death when you are talking about withholding and withdrawing, so this is the debate, and when you're talking about PAS. So maybe it is about time and manner of your death in cases of withholding and withdrawing. But the court will say it's not about time and manner of your death when it comes to physician-assisted suicide. And what is going to be the argument that they use to differentiate those two acts, withholding, withdrawing on the one hand, and PAS on the other? We've seen it multiple times so far in the semester, but give it to me again. What is it that separates these two according to the court, even if Cruzan is about time and manner of your death? Exactly, which is basically another aspect of the intent argument. That's right. In withholding and withdrawing, the court argues, we simply have an omission. And in PAS, we have an act. And so, while it may be the case that you can decide time and manner of your death when the only thing the medical profession is being asked to do is an omission, you cannot decide time and manner of your death when it's PAS, because what will be involved is an act. And what act? The act of?
Killing.
And in omission, the act of?
Letting
die. Wow, great. Somebody's paying attention in this class. Hooray! Okay, good. Exactly. All right. Now, the philosophers know that this act omission thing has just been the thorn in the side, the whole thing. It's always this act omission distinction all the time. So they say, like Rachel's. Boy, they know they're Rachel's. Of course they know they're Rachel's. They say, guys, you keep trotting this act omission distinction out. But what you don't understand is that you have misunderstood the relevant moral principles. And here's why. Because thinking about act and omissions, when someone does not want to die is very different than thinking about act and omission when someone does. That act and omission as a distinction only matters when the person on the receiving end is trotting out a very important right, the right not to be killed. In the right not to be killed, it may make a whole lot of difference when you act versus when you omit to act, when you don't want to die. So be those people who do not want to die. Did I do the trolley car in here? Mm-hmm. Okay, so you know all about the trolley car, that you're riding down this thing, the six people that are tied to the rails that are going to be run over. If the trolley keeps going straight, they don't want to die. And the one person that if you veer it left by your own hand and you act, that would be omission, because I'm just standing there. I'm just standing there. Yeah, boom, boom, boom. We're getting crushed. I'm sorry. They don't want to die. I pull the lever, go this way, runs over mirror. Oh, well, sir, and for she didn't want to die either. Nobody wants to die. The whole trolley car problem is about you people who don't want to die and whether it makes a difference whether you get dead by something I didn't do or you get dead by something I actually did. And then the philosophers, to try to help us get some medical context to that, talk about the case, for example, where two people need organs, both of them want to live, nobody wants to be made dead, but I only have one organ, so I give it to him, and you don't get one, and I'm really sorry, but neither one of you want to die, and so, but you say, yeah, but, you know, it's understandable, autumn omitted to give, let's use heart, because we can't share it, I got one heart. Two people, I omitted to give it to one person, neither one of them wanted to die. You don't fault me, I only have one heart. When you don't want to die, it makes a big difference. And you can see that in this thought experiment. How about I kill her, I get her heart, and I give it to him? In the end, still, only one person got the heart. But boy, do you see a world of difference between, golly, I wish I had two hearts for both of you, but I don't, so you're out of luck, and I know how to get another heart, let's get hers. You see a huge moral distinction, because neither of you want to die, and what you're both saying to me is, when I don't want to die, whether you act and bring about my death, or whether you omit and bring about my death, huge difference. Good. But they say, we take this act-omission thing too far. Because, for example, let's think about this, probably no longer famous, but famous when I was, when Thursday night was the big ABC night and ER was the big moment, you know, that we were all, you know, going for with Friends and Seinfeld and everything. Let's go back to this well-known episode of ER where a British woman with long curly hair, forgotten her name, who cares, gets a rapist. A serial rapist murderer in the ER, and he's bleeding out. And she's like this. La, 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 la. And he's just bleeding and bleeding and bleeding. And the moral conundrum is, are you going to do something here? Are you going to save the guy? And she's omitting to act. How do you feel about that omission? It's a whole lot different. I mean, maybe you're like, yeah, don't do it. He's scum. Maybe you are, because maybe you think that there's something justifiable there. But you certainly don't think about that act as the sad situation of simply omitting to give somebody a heart because you don't have one. Not all omissions are equal. So we trot this act omission thing out as if it just brings total clarity to all situations. Well, it doesn't. There are omissions that seem to us quite morally abhorrent. And if I said that the guy on the table wasn't a serial rapist but her cheating husband, you'd have even less sympathy for her, just letting him bleed. Or what if he's just a Republican? Just letting him bleed, letting him bleed. You're going to be a lot less sympathetic. So omissions aren't the morally heroic, you know, I'm not going to call Max, morally heroic moments of human engagement that they're trotted out to be. That's the first move they make. They say, you think this act-omission distinction, even when people don't want to die, is so crystal clear, well, it isn't. But that's not going to be helpful in PAS, because guess what? You can't say you don't want to die. You're trying to die. Or do I have it wrong? I mean, what are we talking about here? You are confident and you want to die. So no matter what I do to you, you can't say, and you killed me. You're trying to have me kill you or make you dead or hasten your death or whatever sanitized thing you want to say. So you're not going to be able to say to me, you know, Autumn, you're not nearly the good person for having acted on me as you would have been if you just omitted on me. On what grounds would you accuse me of that? You are trying to get my help to make you dead in any way at all. So if you have any preference for how it comes to be, remember, I'm only talking about end of life, terminal illness, end stage. If you have any preference at all about how, as a physician, I help make you dead, which is something you very much want, for that whole list of reasons we gave, I don't know what your reason is at this moment, but you very much want it, you very much considered it, you don't have a lot of time left, and you're asking for my assistance. If you've got a preference for how I help you, does it cut along the act-omission distinction? And if it does, I don't know that acts are the ones that come out on the losing end, for example. If you really want to die, because you're terminally ill, because your life is no dignity, because you're in terrible pain, whatever it is, your end stage, very little time left. My guess is you probably prefer the act rather than the 10 days of starvation while everybody's gawking at you. My guess is if you really do think one is morally superior when you're in that position, it's not the omission. It's the act. In fact, you'd probably rather have to not choke down those pills and maybe throw them up, you know, and all this stuff. If you saw, you know, some of these movies where you get the barbiturates and they're all crushed up, but you can't really eat very well, so you're trying to swallow it with pudding and all that, or just another one, dunch. I mean, if there's you know, a time when you embrace act, you won't call it killing because it's something you want. So you don't say, he killed me, right? You don't say that when you want to die. When you actually do want to die, you're probably going to think that it's action that actually has the superior moral claim, not omission. So back to the philosophers. They say, you guys, you keep trotting out the act-omission distinction to the people who are acting, who are asking to be the recipient of your help. They aren't going to make any distinction between the act and omission. So this thing that everybody keeps trotting out is the pertinent moral principles is only a pertinent moral principle sometimes when you don't want to be killed, and not even all the time at that. But it sure as hell isn't pertinent to the person who's trying to be made dead. And so you keep trotting it out, trotting it out, trotting it out. It's not doing you any bit of moral good. And so, forget it. Just think again about how Kruzan gives us the right to decide the time and manner of our death. Carte blanche in end-of-life cases. Questions on all of that. So that happens in this piece in about 4 incomprehensible paragraphs. And if you want to know where are these hideously complex paragraphs, they're from the little letter B on page 260. They fly by to 262. That is what I just did in a half an hour. Obviously, very dense philosophical work there. But that is what they're arguing. Questions on any of that? So in summary of section number 2, they say there is a liberty interest. Casey sets up the arena, intimate and personal. Kruzan gives us the right of time and manner of our death. Don't even get me started on act omission. I'm not listening to it. It's stupid. You don't know what you're talking about. That's what philosophers say. So in the end, precedent grants us PAS. That's their second argument. Got it? I had to read the thing 30 times before I really nailed down what I've just done there in half an hour. It's very, very complex. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that takes us to the state's interest arguments. What does it mean, the state's interest? I always got caught up on that. Couldn't quite figure out what that was all about early on because I'm not legally trained. In some ways, the first response the layperson has to the state's interest is, none of your friggin' business. So it's kind of hard to understand, what is the state's interest thing? But the idea is, and you see this way back in the Quinlan case, where the state says, the state, in the voice of the governments, this ephemeral thing, in fact, a lot of sociologists do a lot of work thinking about, is there such a thing as the state? Because after all, It's certainly not an entity in and of itself, right? It's not a building. It's not like the Pentagon or the White House. It can't be that. And then it would have to be a bunch of people. So what is the state? So conceptually, excuse me, I always found it a little tricky, but even when you get past that, when you think about the Quinlan case, the argument was the state, the government, can care so much about the citizens that even sometimes when a citizen wants something, the state has to rear its paternalistic or maybe even caring head and protect the citizenry from itself and from what the citizenry thinks it wants. So like a benevolent big brother, the state sometimes has an interest that trumps what you as an individual think you want. That I get to decide as the state that what you want for yourself isn't something I can allow a citizen to do to herself or himself. That's what it means to say it's state's interest. That I know that's what you want, but I'm not going to let you do it. Just like, you know, my 11-year-old, she wants a tattoo. Well, I'm not going to let you have it. I know better that this is not a good idea at 11. Okay, that's the idea of the state's interest. But the thing about the United States is that when the state says it's got an interest that trumps the individual's own interest, the state has to have a damn good reason, because that's the system we're in. So you've got to prove, as the state, that what you care about in the interest of a person is so much more important than what the person deems as important in that person's own life. And the state sometimes makes decisions that it later thinks weren't the right one. Like what? The state in 1975 said Jehovah's Witness are not allowed to refuse blood products when it will save their lives. They just can't. We're going to save it anyway, because their life matters more, their human earthly life matters more to the state than eternal damnation matters to the person who's Jehovah's Witness. Later, the state decided, well, I don't know, you know, eternal damnation's like really long, so maybe they actually do have the right to decide this, and maybe it was our own conception of the good of being in the Christian faith, but not actually Jehovah's Witness, that made us think that was woo loony, because as Presbyterians or Catholics, we don't buy that, so maybe we better let them have their own religious view, and maybe we better not trump their rights with the state's interests. So we've had examples. That's the basic flavor of what's going on here when the philosophers say to the state, your arguments are bogus. Now, they're not so bogus. They're actually pretty powerful, so powerful that this is the section of this class that you will want to note, because these are the types of arguments in the paper that will be at issue. These are not trivial and insignificant arguments. They are arguments, for example, that John Aris, still alive and well in UVA, is making about why we ought not to have federally protected physician-assisted suicide. Some of these arguments are the very consequence-based arguments that you may employ when you decide that you are pro-PAS or you are anti-PAS, or when you're rebutting whichever side. These are straight consequences. What do I mean by that? These are the adverse effects that the state believes will befall the population if we give a federal right to suicide. They're not moral. You have a right. We ought to have the autonomy over body. Not any rights, not any of those principles. These are down with the people concerns. You will be harmed in these particular ways. That's what the state is saying. The philosophers say, I don't buy any of these concerns. Fine. Maybe I don't either. But John Aris does, and he's a very formidable bioethicist. So we shouldn't be thinking that we've got the parochial and the wise here. We have two people, two voices, that both care very deeply about citizens and what is good for citizens, and a disagreement about what will be in the best interest of those citizens, all things considered. So here's what the state says the arguments are. Some of these arguments are better than others, and you'll be the one who decides that when you write the paper. These aren't the only arguments out there. There are tons, but this is the flavor. This is the type of argument that is in bounds when you write your paper. The first argument is from the state. I'm an autumn in the voice of the state. People will die who don't want to die. It will come to be the case that people will get the barbiturates, swallow the barbiturates, who didn't really want to swallow the barbiturates for a whole host of reasons, not because somebody's opened their mouth and fed it to them. It won't be like that, because you have to have a second opinion. You have to be able to get the prescription. You know, there's a lot of things that you have to be a fairly high-functioning dying person to get access to PAS. Nevertheless, people could swallow those pills who don't really want to swallow those pills. The philosophers aren't going to be able, in the absence of a whole lot of data, since 1997, the Oregon Death with Dignity Act is about 5 minutes old, you're not going to have a lot of evidence about physician-assisted suicide. But watch the rebuttal that they make to the argument that in PAS, the wrong people, that is the people who didn't consent, the people who don't want that in their heart of hearts, the wrong people will die. They may not be able to talk about PAS credibly in 1997 because they don't have any data, because it just passed in 1996. So sometimes when you rebut an argument, you go head on. You say, no, that's not happening in PAS. Not going to really be able to do that. You could. You can go look up the statistics, and there's lots of them. You can believe how much literature there is out there. And for the paper, you can go look at it and trot out the data that you think supports your case, but they can't. So they're going to have to refute this, not based on PAS, but based on something else. And that's a very, very savvy rebuttal strategy, is if you can't reject the argument that's made, you use a different argument that will show this to be a very small concern versus a large concern in some other practice. So what could you use right now and back then to say, all right, I hear your worry about PAS. You should be, maybe you should be a little bit worried about PAS, but you should be really worried about, on the grounds that the wrong people are dying, people who didn't want to die are dying. Maybe there is a concern, they say, on PAS, but there's a big, big, big concern about stuff you don't think is problematic. Where should you be worried that people are dying who don't want to die?
Like surrogate decision-making.
On
withdrawal of care.
Right. You think you got big problems with PAS? Maybe you do. But you've got exponentially more problems with withholding and withdrawing. So let's say there are some people, ultimately when this becomes federalized, who didn't want to actually take the pills but felt somehow influenced, or they didn't really want to do it, or whatever, some kind of subtle coercion. How is that spectacularly orders of magnitude different from withholding and withdrawal, at least as it's practiced currently and was being proposed then? What's the difference between PAS and withholding and withdrawing of care? You already named it, but just name it out. You know, just say it very on this concern about people dying who didn't want to die.
Somebody else made the surrogate decision?
Almost always.
Yeah.
Somebody else in withholding and withdrawing is almost always making the decision. Most of the people in the MICU aren't conscious when they're having their care withheld or withdrawn. They're unconscious, and someone else is deciding for them. So you think, maybe, that the competent people might be at some risk for some amount of influence? Great. What about the incompetent people? How about them and what they want? Only Missouri, Florida, and New York have a clear and compelling evidence bar. Everybody else is like, yeah, that's what she'd want. Yeah, that's what she wants. Have you ever seen this really interesting experiment? They divide up a room. 50 people over here or something like that, 50 people over here. They're matched. So Autumn and her partner, Susie and her sister, whatever. And then they say to Susie, here's the scenario. Do you want care withdrawn? And Susie says something. They go over here to Susie's surrogate, Susie's real sister or lover or partner or kid. And they say, so, what do you think Susie would want? Do you know what the odds are of Susie getting it right? 50-50.
Yeah.
My God, that's flip a coin level. That's what it is. So you think you got problems here with the competent knowing what they want? Every day in, day out, people are deciding for others about whether they get their tubes removed, and there is no clear and compelling evidence, and you got a 50-50 chance that you got it right. Now, it's a little bit clearer if you've got maybe an advance directive, maybe you've got a healthcare proxy. I'm just saying without it, and believe you me, there is a lot, as some of you can attest, of people who don't have any of it, already unconscious, and now, well, should we continue, should we not? So the philosophers say, I don't doubt it. But if you permit this, you must permit this. You permit withholding, withdrawing of care among the incompetent. How dare you say that the competent aren't going to be able to make these decisions? Okay, that's a pretty interesting rebuttal. It's a pretty powerful rebuttal. I'm not saying slam dunk. I'm saying it's a pretty clever move. Okay, that's the first argument. Here's the second one. The second argument is this. You got regulations. I'm the state again. Autumn is the state. You got regulations. Are we vacuuming outside?
We are.
Let's shut our door. They don't seem to clean this place for months on end, but if you're having a class, believe me, they're vacuuming. They're even champing. All right. I mean, don't even get me started on the roaches. Which they'll tell you every time you see them, they're dead. Not true. Lance and I were at the photocopier on Thursday. One almost ran over my foot. All right. Forget that nasty story. Anyway, Autumn in the voice of the state. The state will say, you can have regulations, but they're never going to really protect people from abuse. They're never actually going to be able to guarantee that abuses do not happen. Philosophers in rebuttal to this second argument, that regulations may not be fully protective. The philosophers say this. There are always going to be risks whenever a right is granted. There will always be the case where the exercise of a right had some kind of adverse effect. But the problem in the U.S. is that we don't cower about the things that can happen, the bad things that can happen when somebody exercises a right, when there is a preponderance of principle that one ought to have that right. For example, we have the right to bear arms, Second Amendment, right? So people say, why should we have that? If you've got the right to bear arms, there are going to be nut jobs that get machine guns, and they're going to go into schools and kill people. True. There are, sometimes. Yes, it's illegal. They weren't entitled to those guns a lot of the time, though sometimes they actually did pass all of the legal background checks and they weren't stolen. But still, we say the right to have it is so important. I'm not saying that I don't believe in gun control or that I like the Second Amendment. I'm simply saying this is the typical argument made, that right is so important that even if sometimes bad things happen because of it, it's still a right worth having because it's a right we're entitled to. Well, if you're going to make that argument about the case of guns, then in parallel, the philosophers say, the right to decide time and manner of your death is of such a magnitude of importance in the sphere of the intimate and personal that, yes, maybe sometimes someone will fall through the cracks, and yes, the same way that guns get into the wrong hands. But that doesn't mean we start traipsing on rights. The only time when the government traipses on people's rights is when the threat to the populace, to the citizenry as a whole, seems so paramount that our own individual freedoms have to be sacrificed for that protection. I don't know how much you buy that argument, but that's their argument on the second one. That the state will have to... Oh, good, it's still open. Good. Sometimes that thing locks. The state has to show a preponderance of evidence, and the burden is on the state to show that clamping down on rights in the United States has to be done on a particular right because the consequences would be so massive, so widespread and abhorrent that it's worth that traipsing on the rights. And at least pre-9/11, there was a lot of concern about that kind of traipsing on rights. And maybe we're moving back into that era where we have more worries about it. But the point is the same. This is 1997, and they're arguing, you want to curtail rights, you're going to have to show massive risk. You're going to have to say the regulations will fall so far short that the adverse effect will be so huge that it's worth tipping the balance and shortening and curtailing the rights. That's their argument number two. And then number three seems to be a combo of two different concerns. A little bit related to the second, at least the undue influence, has two parts. The undue influence argument and the wrong diagnosis argument. Let's
let's go to wrong diagnosis first, because this is the argument I think is the dumbest of all of the anti-PAS arguments, frankly, though I see it every year. People think it's good. So, you know, up to you. You know, make your case. This one I find to be particularly dumb on two grounds. Autumn in the Voice of the State says this: you can't allow PAS because you might have a person that was given the wrong diagnosis. They swallowed the pills, but they were actually going to live, you know, another 30 years. So you're going to have people swallowing pills that could actually live a really long time. Queen Latifah style, right, in that movie where last holiday she gets the diagnosis, she's got 3 weeks to live. She runs off to a chalet in France, eats up a storm, falls in love with a chef, and luckily gets the good news that it wasn't her x-ray after all. She felt fine for those 3 weeks, enough to be seeing and eating, and she even gets to cook. It's fantastic. And what if she didn't get the news about those x-rays after the 3 weeks was up? She wouldn't wait till she felt terrible. She wouldn't wait till her body was falling apart. She wouldn't wait till she was in agonizing pain. She'd be like, I had 3 weeks of a good time. Where are my pills? I find that to be hopelessly implausible. And here's why I find it to be implausible. Not that doctors don't make mistakes. I'm happy to say you make mistakes all the time. That's not a problem. Actually, I'm tongue-in-cheek there. I actually don't think that, and we'll talk about whether there actually are mistakes in a minute and what type of mistakes. But let's talk about that depiction. That you get a diagnosis, you run out to your favorite doctor and you say, give me the pills, I can have the pills, I'm going to swallow them in 3 weeks after my 3 week vacation. A. The doctors have to have a second opinion. Got to have two opinions. And both of them have to say you're within 6 months of dying. You don't get the pills right away. You got to be in 6 months of dying. So if you've got some dread disease like Huntington's, you're going to die in 10 years. They're not giving you the pills today. You got to be within that 6 months. Number one. Number two, let's think about the evidence, which I understand they didn't have at the time, but let's think about the evidence from Oregon. What is the relationship between people who get the pills and people who swallow the pills in Oregon? What's the correlation? What's the proportion of people who get the pills and then swallow the pills? 100%? Everybody who gets the pills swallows the pills. What's this many people get the pills, this tiny number of people swallow the pills? It's very important data. Lots of people want the pills and they put the pills on the counter, but they don't swallow them. They die from the disease, but they have the pills. During that time, when the pills are on the table, they interview them and say, you haven't swallowed the pills yet. And they say, no, that's just there in case I decide my life's not worth living. I mean, right now I can bear it. And the next day happens, no, today I'm okay. Today was a good day. I'm not, you know. So they're end stage in 6 months, but they're not swallowing the pills. So the picture that you get a diagnosis, you run out, you get the pills, down they go, doesn't seem to be borne out. So Queen Latifah doesn't actually take the pills. She keeps going to the chalet and probably marries the chef and whatever happens. I forget, obviously, the ending of the movie doesn't matter. Point is, this depiction that the psychological, you are dying, will make people go run and get the pills, I think, is experientially not what we see. People take the pills because their life has become what the philosophers describe as intolerable, an existence that no longer feels meaningful. But if you're still eating and living it up and skiing, I'm not sure that PAS is really the model that fits your experience. Well, then let's talk about the wrong diagnosis thing. Let's say it is a wrong diagnosis. Once in a while, it does happen, for example, in hospice. Let's look about hospice qualifications. You can get kicked out of hospice. You can get a renewal of hospice. That's more like it. You get a doctor says you've got 6 months to live. But sometimes physicians can be wrong about how much time you get, especially with certain illnesses like congestive heart failure. It's really hard to predict. Sometimes people are just living and living. So they say, yes, you're within 6 months. 6 months come and go, and you're still alive. So you got to get your hospice renewed. Well, very few people get their hospice renewed. Very few people need to get their hospice renewed. Of the people who need to get their hospice renewed, almost all of them do get their hospice renewed. In other words, it's not like they said, oh, you're right. I don't know how we were thinking about that. You're going to be here 20 years. You're kicked out of hospice. It can happen, but it's very, very rare. In other words, when it's a wrong diagnosis at the end of life, the physicians in here can speak to this and the nurses, but it's often about, I thought you had 6 months, you have 8 months. It's not usually, I thought you had 6 months and you got 30 years. So the wrong diagnosis thing feels, I'm not saying there's not any risk at all. I'm saying really relative to, you know, the grand scheme of things, I don't think we're actually talking about diagnosis as much as prognosis and time. Now you can dispute that and we can have a debate.
But here's the thing. Let's say you're one of those people who got the pills and you spent it on the counter, and now you're saying to yourself, I can tolerate it today. Today my family came, I can tolerate it, I'm going to live another day, I'm going to live another day. And then the day comes and you're like, you know what, it's been 4 days, I can't get any relief, they're upping my morphine, but then I can't think, I know I'm no longer able to take care of myself, I'm in a diaper, I can't shower anymore, I'm not making any sense, I'm unconscious most of the day, today's the day, I'm going to take the pills and. Now what if somebody said, well, guess what, you could live in this state for another 7 weeks. I don't see how that is comforting to anybody. That it, by the time you think your life, your existence isn't bearable, you're not rejoicing that you got more time. I'll give you the tragic example of my friend Joe. In the last 3 weeks of his death from a brain tumor, he said every day, how long is this going to go on? How much longer is this going to go on? If we and it went on 3 weeks from the time he started saying that. What if we said, I don't know, how about 6 more months? That would not be a comforting thing. So this idea that if people are going to take the pills for the wrong diagnosis, maybe there's a way of salvaging the argument. It seems of the all the concerns one should have, wrong diagnosis seems to be a little bit hairy. And certainly, prognosis-wise, if there's any counter, any kind of comparative that we ought to worry about, why don't we worry about Karen Ann Quinlan having her ventilator removed to hasten her death and then living 9 years in the fetal position? If you can get the diagnosis wrong, at least in terms of prognosis, I mean how long you've got wrong when you're a patient who's considering PAS, let us do remind ourselves that you can get it wrong too when you're talking about withholding or withdrawing a therapy, especially the Quinlan case with the ventilator. So I don't find wrong diagnosis of all of these concerns about negative consequences, some of them very, very serious. I'm not sure that this one is your big slam dunk. And obviously it's one of my pet peeves, so, but if you want to go up and, you know, you want to trot that one out in your paper, have at it. But now let's talk about undue influence, because this one is, I think, very troubling for a lot of people. And it was what folks said when they were talking about financial burden and emotional burden and some of those other reasons. Let's imagine that I, Autumn, am able to endure the dying. That I find my ability to think it, to watch a sunset, to have reflective time about my life, just to know that I'm in the company of my loved ones. I find that meaningful in and of itself. But I also know that my savings that I want to pass on to my children are dwindling and dwindling. Or I know that their studies are being affected. Not right now, because they're in elementary school and they don't even do their homework. But let's imagine. Or my husband is taking so much time off from his job that widget they're trying to get through the FDA isn't going to get through. And then who knows, you know, what will happen to my family. He needs to get back to work. Maybe those are the factors that make me not only get the pills, but swallow them in my last, you know, though I have some more weeks. A woman on an island, maybe I wouldn't do it. But yes, those external influences are the reason that I do it. So it's not that I think my life is unbearable. It's that I find that what I'm doing to others is, for me, psychically unbearable. And maybe it's even not just Autumn's original thoughts. Maybe I'm getting feedback like, no, Mom, I'm not that tired of taking care of you. Don't worry. I mean, I got 2 hours of sleep, so I'm ready. Maybe it's other kind of feedback I'm getting from my loved ones. Or, Susie, why do you look so stressed? Well, Mom, you know, I don't want you to worry about it. I just can't pay the bills, but, you know, there's no food. Or, you know what I mean? So all these kind of influences. And that, says the state, is something that maybe we need to prevent people like Autumn from swallowing the pills, because maybe it's not that Autumn can't tolerate her own life, it's that Autumn is being influenced either by what she imagines the suffering of others or directly being told are the suffering of others, financial, emotional, you name it, whatever. And maybe then, therefore, I'm being unduly influenced. Maybe it's not what I want, it's that I'm doing it for others. This seems to me a pretty serious problem. I'll tell you what the philosopher's rebuttal is, and you'll be able to think about it, and we'll adjourn. The philosophers say this: Americans have the right to make the decisions when they're confident for themselves, and part and parcel of that right is having the right to be influenced by anyone you choose to be influenced by. We cannot protect people from being influenced by anyone they choose to be influenced by or by any factor that they choose to have be materially influential in their life. It's not our business. Now, if you, the state, in your conception of the good, believe that the only people who should make decisions like that are people who want it for themselves and for no others, you're imposing your woman on an island conception of human life on people who may think more communitarian-wise about their life. And I'm going to give you an example, and we'll close with this. We had an oncologist in the program, and he told this story years ago. He said, I had the patient who was dying of cancer, but, or was certainly in metastatic cancer, very serious situation. He was a minister in West Philadelphia, and he said to me, to the oncologist, Doc, I'm wondering, now that I have at this fork in the road, when I have to decide aggressive chemotherapy or hospice, I'm wondering if you would come and talk to my congregation. Because as the minister, the way that we make decisions in our community is as a flock, as a community, as one body. And I'm not going to make this decision by myself. I'm going to make it in the wisdom of the elders and my people, my congregation. And I don't know that I can explain everything to them. I want you to explain it from a medical perspective, and then I want them to dialogue and guide me with, you know, in the spirit and with our religious views and with our values. So he does. He goes, the oncologist goes to this congregation in West Philadelphia, and he explains the whole medical situation and the odds and what the trajectory would be like, either direction, and his prediction. It's not a crystal ball, but what he thinks will be the likely course and what suffering will unfold if he goes down the hospice path or if he decides to go with the aggressive therapy path. And then the congregation has a dialogue with the minister together. And as a body, they decide what is best for him is hospice. And he decides not to have the aggressive chemotherapy. What the philosophers are saying is, that's his business. That's his value system. That's his conception of the good. The man, the minister, felt very much at peace, knowing that he was held by that entire group who had very much his interest, but his full interest, as they understood interest, his spiritual interest, his family's interest, the congregation's interest, that was a group of people that loved him, and he loved them, and they decided as one community. And the philosophers say, if that, in the microcosm of your life, whether it's your family, your partner, your children, your community, your town, if that's how you make a decision, well, that's America. Because that's what the government was supposed to enable you to do, to give you the space to do that. So when they talk about undue influence, they say, well, who are you, the state, to tell me that it was undue? Because we're all influenced. Undue means that that what was influential to me was not kosher, was not legitimate, was not above board. But from what vantage point do you decide that for me? All told, whatever you think about these consequence-based arguments, the philosophers believe that they have slam-dunk refuted the state's concern that they need to protect the citizenry from the adverse effects of PAS. They believe that the liberty interest is already read in the precedent of prior cases, and they believe that if abortion and other cases that give us an extension of liberties is permitted by the 14th Amendment, then surely time and manner of death and PAS, therefore, would be included. All right. That's that. Next week, we're going to look at another interesting argument that is also written by a philosopher, Velleman, alive and well at NYU. And he is somebody who believes in his own right to have physician-assisted suicide, but is adamantly opposed to a federal legal right. And we'll find out why.